Are we supposed to, like, wait till everyone says
I think that's probably a good idea just to... I'll just mumble for a few minutes until everyone... It's quite... Well, everyone just settles themselves down.
Well, my background is the theatre. And
I know, you're really famous. Like, I see you on the telly, you know, you're on the couch.
Come on now, I gotta do this. Okay, so...
Just in case the one person on the back row...
No,
please.
Let me just say this, okay, because I'm going to pick up on what you just said. Yeah. I just published a novel called Entropy. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's got a dystopia in it. Mm. And this dystopia takes place in 2044. Mm. And I did a lot of work on nanotechnology.
Oh, right.
So this is interesting to me because one of the things that this dystopia sort of postulates is that three things. Mm. And first of all, I'll say that to go back to what you were saying about reality, I mean, playwrights manipulate reality, and so do novelists. So we create and manipulate reality. But to go back to this nanotechnology, it's very interesting to me. One of the contentions in the novel is that we are at the space now where our machines are actually becoming smarter than we are. And our machines are learning from each other. Mm. They're dialoguing with each other. Yeah. There's a dialogue that we don't quite understand the dialogue, and we don't quite realize it. So in the novel, what I've done is I've created this universe where we have, they're not really screens anymore. We don't need screens anymore in 2044. We can actually put our hand up and certain realities can come up. But that our little robots who do the work have copied gestures so that we become empathetic to them. So for instance, if I have a little robot who cleans my floors, if I do like this, my little robot will do like this, and it'll make me like it. Yeah. The other thing that the novel has is...
Can I ask you, Bonnie, I'm really bad at this. I empathize with my push bike because I think I'm slightly autistic like that, and I'm better with machines.
I'm slightly that too,
you know,
yeah.
And why don't we do that already with, like, the fridge or the cooker?
I think we're giving out more information than we're aware of. And that's one of the things that I'm kind of nervous about a little bit. I mean, I won't be around when it really happens, but I think we do that. I think we do empathize with various objects that we have, and that what science will do is recreate these tiny, nudgy, little empathetic things in order to get us to buy it. I mean, we'll have trousers that when we walk into Gap, they'll say, "Hey, Mark, here I am. This is your size." You know what I'm saying? This is, I want those. Yeah, these are your trousers, and this is for you, and this is your size. So I am interested in this world of nanotechnology because I think people who don't consider themselves scientists, people in this country are made to feel frightened of science because they think of people with their hair all over the place and white coats, and they've been blackened from explosions. But you know, there isn't this. There's a fear of science. So in this country, I think people are not aware of how a lot of things that they're doing can be used to make scientific gadgets. Yeah. Like even, you know, calling up a call center. In the book, they call voices so that when they make these robots, they put very empathetic voices in them. And, you know, so that kind of thing. So nano is very interesting.
Our fire alarm at UCL has this incredibly empathetic voice. You know, now there is a fire. Please proceed gently and cautiously, not screaming or running. to the nearest exit. I just love that. I mean, what are they thinking?
What? Well, you know, is this creation of empathy?
Yeah.
And
what's the end result of your, you know, these little nanobots?
The little nano things.
That can empathize.
Well,
that's very weird. They're
in
control. People then to you.
Yes,
you
they're in control, and they actually, because we are becoming lazier and lazier, and we are as a species. Even though it looks like we're not, we are. Mm. And we're also developing body shapes that are more akin to people in front of screens than in, you know, actually who stand up straight and walk. So as the time goes on, we're going to have these little things who are going to do what we need to do. Mm. And we're just going to sit and vegetate, which is what people are doing anyway.
Yeah.
And I'm just interested in how our brain is not moving as fast as those artificial brains that we have created, that whether we are aware that the brain, the Western brain, let's put it this way, as opposed to anything, but the Western brain, the brain that we have developed in this part of the culture, is actually not moving as fast as the machines that we make.
Just a couple of things. Is on the machines, I was always... It seems to be a cultural problem, the empathy with machines.
Yes,
because the Japanese, where... if Mark Miodovnik here, the materials girl, correct me, but the robot called Asimov, which is this, you know, amazing robot that can sort of wander along, pick up things, and they have these in Japan. They've now got the... they've got two arms, and they use them in geriatric hospitals for picking someone up. They'll come up, pick the person up from the bed, and then take them to the bath. I mean, they're on wheels. They're not a walking robot. Mm-hmm. They're on wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be that the Japanese really easily or quite readily embrace this robotic era, and have done that far more than we have done.
Yes.
And obviously that pushes research on in different directions and funding and things like that. So it's definitely a cultural phenomenon.
Mm.
Some people, for whatever, some cultures, seem to be able to take that on and are more comfortable with it. So there seems to be the plasticity that we have, and we all have a lot of plasticity in our brain, is there and available. But there are certain cultural constraints that are not allowing that to happen. So that's in terms of how comfortable. In terms of how fast the brain is evolving relative to machines, that's a very good question. We have evolved amazingly well in the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, 100 years ago, if I was doing this thing on, because I'm an imaging department, we didn't have x-rays. You know, there was no, if you were shot or you had, you know, a splinter in your finger, there was no way of finding out. The only way to find out where it was, you go into an operating theatre, someone cut you up and look for it. 100 years ago, and we've had to change massively all the way through the nuclear age,
accommodating
that, industrialization. We have an amazing capacity to alter. I think the brain is remarkably plastic. I imagine that as technology develops, that we will also develop with it. Now, whether that's a good or bad thing, I don't know, because we are certainly reluctant to change, and that's what worries me as a nation and as a person, that I'm very reluctant to change.
Well, see, that's where I think art and culture come in, because I think when you were saying that when an artist comes into your environment, maybe I'm misquoting you, that the artist hadn't changed you.
Doesn't change our research, usually, because you know what it's like. If I walked into your world and tried to tell you how to write a play, you'd go, what the bloody hell are you talking about?
Well,
you know, I mean, amazing, quite possibly, you know, the odd thing happens, but usually you guys are professionals, you know what you're doing, and you probably don't need me unless it's for a little odd chat about something to do with the brain or feeding a few ideas about nanobots. And it's probably the same for the artists. You need quite a lot of background knowledge, but generally, certainly cultural placement of it is different. Or those general conversations.
Well, Mark, you know, that's why I disagree with you, because I think that that to be a playwright, and it's spelled with a W-R-I-G-H-T for a reason, is because you're building realities. I'm also a synesthete as well. So this idea of actually building realities, manipulating reality, manipulating sound, space, time, is a scientific thing. I mean, you can't I think a lot of playwrights, or some playwrights, think that plays are about words. That's the last thing a play is about. It's absolutely the last thing that it is about. First of all, it's about the understanding of space, an understanding of how the human body and the human story builds itself in space. And so for me, it's about time. I write plays. Plays exist in time. You can't really have a very good play unless you understand something about time, unless you understand about how time works, what you do with time, what you do with space, how you create space in a script, how you make, and in the building of space and time, character assembles itself. The shape of the play begins to assemble itself. But you work as a playwright at a very minute level, very small, very, very micro mm-hmm. level, in which, for me, for instance, I think about if I have a piece that I'm doing at the Royal Festival Hall that's going to be 48 minutes. So for me, I think in terms of time frames, break the time frames down and think about what exists in the time. And I think a lot of more playwrights do that than they don't. So in a way, it is a method, in a sense.
It's a learned method. I mean, you guys... Mm. That whole central temper of a piece doesn't come perhaps to some more readily than others, but it's a skill that's work that you develop over a period of time, and you know when it's flowing and things like that. And for me to try to walk into your world and that would be damn near impossible, you know. And so there's two things. One, in order to do that, you have to work it, and that means you work quite hard. You're everywhere, Bonnie. And what's the drive for you to do that, to keep working it, to keep getting this form and improving the form, whether through a book or through a play? What's that drive?
Well, but see, I think it's like what you do. It's what you do. It's you want to see something that doesn't exist. Mm. You know, you want to make the thing that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And it isn't very interesting to make something that does already exist because the thing exists. But to see that isn't there yet, and to find a way to make that thing that isn't there translatable. And the way to make it translatable, the only way that I can do it, is through words. Yeah. When I was a child, it was through mathematical equations, and then
were you better at maths than you were at English?
I was, but be seen.
You sold your soul to the arts.
What happened is I grew up in a family of working class family, and my parents could only afford this much education for me.
Chicago.
So I couldn't go any further than I did in secondary school. So I had to find a way to be able to translate this. And so I taught myself to be articulate. But the thing that's happening behind me is not about words at all. Absolutely not.
Can I ask them, so where did you as a kid, if you use words as this skill that you, in order to negotiate your environment to that period of time. And of course, when you have to do something for a reason, you become pretty good at it. And
you
work
you have
it,
to, yeah, yeah.
You know, because you're fairly chatty.
Yeah, exactly.
My mother would say gobby.
No, but it's true. But it should give you an indication of somebody who actually doesn't speak. If this makes any sense to you,
no.
It's like kind of synesthesia is on the autism spectrum.
Do you want to explain what synesthesia is?
Yes, synesthesia.
And what kind you have?
Okay, there's lots of different kinds of synesthesia. I mean, there's the classic synesthesia where you literally can't see a word without it being in a color or an image or a sound. Mm. It's a kind of primitive brain whereby the hemispheres kind of overlap or they touch one another.
Yeah.
And more females have it than males, and it is inherited.
Yeah.
So I would suspect on my mother's side, there were probably synesthetes, but
they wouldn't
have known.
Yeah.
I didn't know I was a synesthete until I was reading something and a woman raised her hand and said, "How long have you been a synesthete?" And I just burst into tears. I thought,
How old was that?
Oh, God, this was 8 years ago.
No way.
Yeah, I had no idea. No, because I thought everybody was like this.
So what do you see? Describe what you see.
Well, your name.
Right.
is silver, like steel, but there are little cracks in it. Tiny little fine hair cracks.
Because there's different kinds. Do you get that? Is it a sort of taste or a shape or a feeling?
I get image.
You get image.
I get image.
Wow.
And so that makes me very impatient because the words come out in images. And it took a long time for me to write that book because I had to translate the color of the words and the images down so that it could be intelligible to other people. And it's taken me a long time. So being able to talk is kind of the end process. More stuff is happening that I can't say than that I say. Otherwise, I would just be sourcing.
Can I tell you one of the lovely stories I like about synesthesia, or why you have it, is that we were all, as a little fetus, you know, in our mums, we were all synesthetes. And effectively, all the areas of the brain were connected up. And then as we developed, you have this thing called neuronal pruning. So you're not only growing brain cells and the connections, but you're also losing them in time. Like we all used to have webbed fingers, you know, and as a baby, you lose that. But for the synesthetes, that neuronal pruning didn't go on in certain areas. So you're left with these connections. And I just think it's such a lovely visual image for me. And it's a great hypothesis that we were all that at one time. But some of you have the remnants of this connection from when you were a baby. Yeah.
And I would think it was probably developed as a way for people to survive as well. Because I think the only way that we would have been able to survive as a species is because we had enormous imagination and that we had narrative skill. That we were able to remember that this was not the place where you went hunting because this had a cesspool and you could fall into it and you could die. So it was this kind of...
Manchester.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, no, I love Manchester. I love Manchester.
Oh, God, sorry,
I
Manchester.
Love Manchester. I really do. I really love Manchester.
So what was growing up like for you at home? So you're in Chicago. Maybe for whatever reason you didn't go on to do further education. So what did you do then, you know? How did you sort of survive? And you've learned that you can chat, you can articulate, you can get on with people. Where did you go through? How did you work through
just
things?
Just reading a lot, and always been interested in mathematics.
Wow.
Didn't know a lot about science, but only science connected with mathematics. But always pure mathematics has been always.
And what drove you on in those early days? Was there a love of the, you know, the written form, or was it just you were on an adventure?
It was numbers, and then I discovered Shakespeare, because there are a lot of numbers in Shakespeare.
Wow.
And there's a lot of music in Shakespeare. Mm. So for a synesthete, that's really, Shakespeare's wonderful because he's very musical, and he's full of numbers and full of shapes. So it was... It got me further and further into the theater because that's where he did his work.
So where, and I've lost the connection here. So you're reading away, you're doing all this stuff. You're, maybe I suggest, as so many other people are in the arts, driven, you know, you're pushing forward for something. Maybe you don't know what it was. Where was that sort of, you know, that tipping point for you when you knew this is what I want to do, this is where I'm going. I found something that I love, that I can put all my energy and enthusiasm. And my mum and dad will be so proud of me if I can do this.
Well, I wrote plays when I was 8 years old, so I never knew anything before that. So there wasn't any decision.
Wow.
See, there wasn't any sort of decision. It was always there. I was always writing since I was a child.
And did you take that from, you know, because I see playwrights, I'm always slightly nervous around them because they're sort of analysing you. They're looking at all those, you know, little eccentricities you have and the way you do things, and the next thing you're transposed into this weird scientist in some place somewhere.
No.
You know, so I'm always... But were you as a child, therefore, you must have been relatively empathetic. You're taking aboard all these conversations.
Totally. It's a wonder I'm still alive. No, seriously. No, really. Very empathetic. Highly empathetic.
And
highly.
I'll tell you one story, then I will ask you whether it's ever been detrimental.
Yes.
I walked down a street with someone that was very empathetic. I class myself as quite a systemizer, less empathetic. And it was a girl, and we came across a paving in the street that had a crack in it, and she went, "Oh my God, I feel so sorry for the paving in the street." Now, I thought that's probably a little pathological.
Over. Yeah. A little bit.
Has it ever, obviously it's benefited you in some respects, and there's no free lunches with the brain. Has it ever held you back?
Yeah, because it because I can empathize with anything.
Yeah.
And so you have to create barriers in order to function. Yeah. And also because of the empathy, you become curious about everything.
Yeah.
So that's one reason it's easy to talk, because I'm very fascinated by human beings. I'm fascinated with human nature and by human nature and how we function. And I'm fascinated with how human nature and how human beings work in relation to, full stop, in relation to each other. So when people say to me, why don't you, I don't go to the theater very much, and I don't read novels very much, even though that's what I do, because it's not very interesting. What's interesting is a scientist is much more interesting to me, or a mathematician is much more interesting, or a sports person is much more interesting, because that's a bridge that I have to cross, and it expands that empathy. So it's a much more fascinating realm.
Yeah.
And so in researching this dystopia, I had to enter areas that I knew nothing about, like about the brain, the cyber stuff. Yeah, and the hemispheres of the brain.
Right.
And how, as you say, that those hemispheres can be manipulated.
Yeah.
And the book is also about memory as well.
Mm.
So it's about how we assume that our memory is a narrative that goes A, B, C, D, E, F, G, but of course it isn't. That's a construct.
Mm.
And I've had a brother who's had a gun put to his head, and he thought the trigger was going to be pulled. And it is true that your life opens up in front of you, but it isn't what people think it is. It isn't, you know, I'm 3 years old now. It is this thing that comes out. And so I wanted to create and do create in my work a kind of memory, a kind of field whereby it allows the spectator or the reader to see that these things are culturally determined.
Yeah.
These things are genetically determined, that we pick out bits and pieces of this to believe and to remember.
Mm-hmm.
We are all in this room. We have all made a cultural agreement that we are in this room. Although as a scientist, you know that you can test that there's heat in this room. Certain things are happening here. So obviously there are human beings in this room. But we are in agreement that we're here. And that I get very frustrated as a writer in reading most novels, because most novels are written very much in the 19th century. And it's sort of like jumping into a Model T when you live in an age of the kind of age that we live in. And I always think, why can't we read and go to the theater the way scientists work and the way mathematicians work? We, people in culture in general, are very old-fashioned. It's a very old-fashioned way of reading and a very old-fashioned way of experiencing the theater, whereas we are light years ahead in science, light years ahead in mathematics. And so for me, it is an attempt, and it's sometimes, most of the time, it's a failure, because always the theater is a failure to a certain extent. It's the attempt to try to lay out this field and to show the spectator and to show the reader that these things are random, that in fact, this thing you call memory is a random experience, culturally determined, culturally built by wherever you are. Mm. I was reading Gladwell's book, which I thought was interesting in that there's so many, say, Asian kids are so good at mathematics, and he says very simple to understand is how they read. And so that part of their brain is developed so that they're very good with science and so forth. And we in the West have some sort of addiction to the idea of beginning, middle, and end. But that isn't really what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, we have had, in the English language, we've had Virginia Woolf, and we've had James Joyce, and we've had the modernist, who from the trauma of the war attempted to break through that A, B, C, D, E, F, G barrier, and then it was snatched back.
Mm.
So we're actually regressing as readers, and we're regressing as theater people into this kind of very, not even medieval, but a very 19th century notion of how to read and how to see things. And I think as a result, to go back to what I said at the beginning, as a result, our brains are slowing down and our machines are beginning to have dialogue with one another and talk to one another. And I don't think we're aware of how much we've allowed those computers to run things. If the computers, I mean, this is a science fiction nightmare, but they can get to the point where they're so intelligent that they can say, well, what are these things about?
I wish my computer was as intelligent as that. I mean, you're more perhaps more hopeful than me. I mean, I see the computers on a daily basis, and they're never that bright, and mine's always breaking down, and Windows I hate, and God forbid, the programs never work, and you know, the human mind is, you know, incredibly complex, more complex than any computer that we have or one that we can imagine. So I think there's hope for the human brain as yet.
I hope so.
Although, you know, the computers are quite good at some things. The one couple of issues there is one day, you mentioned that, and I love the way you celebrated science and mathematics, and you said that, and I'll paraphrase you now, probably wrong, that culture was somewhat procure. You know, in some respects, you know, it was slightly old-fashioned, I think, was the word you used. And I have one gripe. It's things like the culture show. We never see science, despite the fact it infects us from the day we get up in the morning till the day we go to bed, whether it's our car, our transport.
Mark, I have to tell you a secret.
What's that?
I don't watch television, so I don't know what it is.
The culture show, okay.
I mean, I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
So, okay, so, well, truthfully, I don't watch it regularly, if that's any consolation. Okay. So I used to say there's a program on telly that supposedly, you know, covers a lot of culture. You never see science on that. And I find that, well, mildly insulting, but deeply frustrating as well. It's as though science isn't part of culture. We seem to be on the fringes, either not allowed in, or it still hasn't been embraced. It's as though we don't seem to have worth or value. Yet you're saying that's not your experience at all?
It's a culturally accrued response. There was a time in this country, as you know, that this country. I was interested in the guy you were with here before because
Charles.
Because
he's got a girlfriend.
Oh no, I'm not interested in him. I don't like boys. Never have. The men I prefer. So I'm not to say that he isn't, but you know what I'm saying.
I know what you're saying.
Okay.
Your secret's safe.
Yeah. No. What I'm interested in is there was a time when the French led the whole kind of world and sort of all of the scientific and mathematical thinking. And then the British led the world in applying this thing. I mean, almost made me cry when I realized that they're just getting around to the fact that Alan Turing may have been, and I think he was, the person who won World War II, okay, for the whole of the Allies. And the fact that he doesn't have, you know, Churchill's up there and Turing should be next to him. And the fact that he isn't is a cultural thing. And I don't know what's happened here. There seems to have suddenly become a fear of science and scientists, mathematicians, where some of the greatest brains in all those fields exist now and have always existed. So when you bring up this fact about the culture show, it actually makes culture dumber when it doesn't actually understand that making a painting, making a piece of music, making a play is a scientific and almost mathematical act. And whether you understand it to be that is another thing. Mm. I think if we had that our culture is determined by journalists, it's defined by journalists who have an antipathy a lot of times to scientists who have a different kind of mind. I think if mathematicians and journalists sat in parliament and ran things, I think we have a much better situation, to be honest with you.
Where does this, you know, it's clear that you've got this fascination for the science or this openness. And is that because, of the education, of course, of friends, people you knock around with, you know, scientists that you have dinner with or whatever? Or was it because of that early mathematics thing that you just sort of connected with? But because it's so cultural, I feel as though there's got to be some other reason why you embrace science so readily, which so many people don't.
Well, you know, but I didn't know I did. Yeah. See, that's the thing. I didn't know that I did until a couple of years ago. But I've always been, since I was a child, fascinated by the number three. And when I did trigonometry in my secondary school, which was the last formal relationship that I'd ever had with mathematics, I was very interested in it. Mm. But when I was at school, girls were not encouraged to do this.
Yeah.
This was not what girls did, you know. And so I read history instead, which I adore and loved, but it wasn't the path that you were allowed to go down. Yeah. But, you know, that thing that you are never dies. It just goes to sleep until something happens, an event happens, which happened to me, which woke it up.
Yeah.
So I'm very, very passionate about this conversation that I think culture and science need to have for the sake of culture.
It drives me mad that there's not more women in science. And Mark's an engineer, and he's at King's, and, you know, I think I remember he's like 2% of women in, you know, are in his materials engineering class, which is just unbelievable. I can't believe
it's that a total
there's
prejudice.
Not a capacity in
it's
any
prejudice.
Way, shape, or form.
It's just, outrageous.
It is completely.
It is, and I think we need to step back and look at it. You know, and people talk about the metric system and complain about the metric system. The whole of Westminster is built in the metric system. I mean, it's crazy. But this stuff isn't told to people. So, and I don't know why it isn't. Mm. And I don't, you know, someone who's read history, I'm interested in the moment when it stopped, because it wasn't, there was a time when there was the Enlightenment and you know, all of this interest in science and mathematics in this country.
Yeah.
And the whole of Princeton and MIT.
Sure. Yeah.
But you wonder why it's happened. And I work with kids in the inner city. And
what's that like?
Well,
crazy?
No, it's wonderful, because that's where I come from. And I tell them, you are mathematicians. How do you make, the hell do you think you make music? Yeah. You're counting.
Yeah, sure.
What do you think it is? If you're rapping, you're counting. So don't be scared. Just... that's what it is.
Yeah.
But I don't have the tools, because I wasn't given the tools. So all I can say is, it's you guys are already doing it. You ladies are already doing it. So now here's a book, or go look at this, and then maybe somebody can take you to the next level.
Can I ask you this? I'm fascinated by what drives people, but also how you get the most out of yourself. Mm. You know, you've talked about the kids, you're trying to get the most out of them. Malcolm Gladwell bangs on, just work hard, you'll get there in the end. I don't believe it's as simple as that.
No,
I believe
it isn't,
that you have to create the right kind of space in order to be able to think creatively. And we've heard about people having a shower and those moments of inspiration. You know, people dream. It doesn't matter whether it's Sam Taylor Coleridge and Kubla Khan, you know, Kekul, the benzene ring. In different or places outside work, we have those creative moments. How do you get into the right space for you to come up with something, whether you've got a block, or you're looking for a way through something? Where's the space? Is it the shower, the bath?
You know, it's like what Bach said about his music. You know, they asked him, how do you compose it? He said, how do I not compose it? You know, how do you stop? It's something that, you know, Kirk Douglas said once that I loved.
Kirk Douglas, great philosopher.
He's a great philosopher. And he said, you know, he's fabulous.
Great
and
little
he said,
dimple in the chin thing.
No, but he's a great philosopher. And he said, you got to know, you got to understand your instrument. And then when you do understand it, either by yourself or someone, you're lucky enough and someone's helped you, then you have to have enormous energy. You have to there are more talented people than people who express their talent. But what happens is you need energy. It takes getting up every morning.
It really takes
energy. It's like any athlete will tell you, any dancer, you get up and you exercise every day. You exercise that thing. And you never, ever, you prepare it so that moment when genius strikes, which is once every 8 years, you're ready.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It doesn't happen. And I tell kids that all the time. You have to work it's work, it's work,
yeah.
it's work.
Einstein was good. In 1905, when he wrote these amazing, you know, papers and he got all this stuff, and E equals MC squared, it wasn't as though it just came to him in a blinding flash. He lost, in a three-month period, stones. I mean, he worked obsessively day and night. This is a phenomenally bright guy, but he still works so desperately hard. There's just no way
around. It's work.
And is that the same for you? Are you just sort of cruising around, taking it easy, and you're only, really, as my mum would say, you're only using 10% of your brain.
I write every day.
Every day,
Every day. It doesn't mean you publish or anybody else sees it. I write every day.
Wow.
And I've done it since I was eight.
And what's the drive for that? Is it that, you know, the fame and glory or being able to, you know...
Whatever. it's how I talk to myself.
Great end.